This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
All right. This episode of Enough About Me is episode, I don't know, whatever it is, like 3026. A couple of notes before we get to our guest. First of all, a couple of years ago on my old show, Jerry Callahan and I would bring in, this is when we started bringing in like a third person, the very beginning of it, and we were trying everybody under the sun, and this guy Mark Dondero had come on, it sort of come on the scene at the press conferences with Belichick and asked him some sort of odd, goofy sort of off-the-wall questions. And then we thought, this is kind of funny. Like, this is interesting that he's doing this and sort of mocking the whole process, which we were doing too, and talking to the media and all that stuff. So we said, let's bring him in. And we brought him in from 9 to 10, I think it was, on a Friday. And he was a fucking zombie, like a zero. He added nothing to the conversation. During the first break, yes, that's what time we got up in the morning. I thought, well, this is it. I don't think we need to do any more of this. And, you know, I kind of would watch him from a distance. A couple days ago, I retweeted it. Go find it out. Go look it up. It's funny. He tweeted out a video of a bunch of media members in Boston, my town, Boston, reacting to the Celtics losing the series. And one of them is me. He had like a bald head on and he did this thing where it was me on Periscope. But he's like, yeah, I don't know when the show's coming back. And just mocking me, which was very, very well done. I thought it was really funny. So keep an eye out on that one. The William Bendtson feedback is incredible. The Bendtson experience, the freight train that is William Bendtson Patriots, has taken over the city. Huge numbers on Friday for him. I think his social media is like doubled or tripled. We're going to have him on again soon. Don't worry about that. And then I had Mike Lombardi on yesterday. And so this was the rare time where some of the Minifans struck back at me, which, listen, I'm trying to be less and less sensitive as I get older. But this one hurt my feelings a little bit. They said, oh, you're soft. You did a pussy interview with Lombardi. What are you doing? You know, why are you being nice to him after you killed him a couple of years ago? And my reaction to that was, so like 3 years ago, as I tweeted out, Lombardi and I had a fight on the air. It was me and Portnoy, and like I said, my old partner was on. And we fought, and we talked about, you listened to the podcast with Lombardi yesterday, you heard it. And I do think my reaction to Lombardi not answering my questions was over the top. Was it entertaining for the listeners? Yes. Would I do it again if it happened again? Probably I would. Do I think it was a manifestation of my anger at the station I was working at and was going on in my personal life with my parents, who were both really sick at that time? Yes, I think so. And like I said, I should have called Lombardi off the air. It built every week because I think Lombardi wanted no part of somebody asking him tough questions. I will say this about Lombardi, and he's very nice. I'm glad he came on. It was a good sport, but he doesn't want to have a conversation. Like, he just wants to talk to you. He's a football guy, and you're not. He knows more football than you. Just sit there and deal with it. I didn't want to do that interview anyway. I sort of got talked into having him on every week. I didn't want to do it. And my reaction to not wanting to do it was to be a fucking child and ruin it, which can be entertaining, I admit. So I decided to sabotage the whole thing, as opposed to, I probably could have called Lombardi or had one of the old producers give me his number. We could talk it out. But I elected not to do that. So I don't really even really regret it necessarily, but I thought it'd be interesting to hear from the perspective of somebody who was on the other side of it. I think people were saying, oh, what are you going to have him on every week now? Oh, you're a football. Like, no, I think it's, who else would do that? That's all. Like, where else are you getting that? The side of the other guy. And me saying, well, this is why I did it. And he said, well, this is what I thought. I just thought it was interesting because I don't think you're going to find it anywhere else. But what can you do? one other thing before we set up my guest here. So I saw Stern, who obviously is my idol. I'm not going to pretend he's not. Has his book coming out. Is it tomorrow or is it next week? It might actually be tomorrow. Howard Stern comes again. That's called. It's a collection of his interviews. I have to admit, I don't have a lot of interest in it. But he's been doing the sort of the rounds here. I saw he was on Jane Pauley's CBS Sunday Morning Show. Hollywood Reporter, the New York Times did a long interview with him. So he's picking his spots. Like, you know, we tried for him, but he wasn't going to do anything with somebody like me. You know, he's going to have somebody, you know, he's got his friends now. He has his bubble, which is okay, I guess. You know, I understand it. But it's funny that the toughest interview, you know, the old toughest interviewer of all time doesn't want to take a single tough question. That's okay. But what I find interesting is not even Stern. Like, Stern has a narrative and he's selling it out there. I've changed. I've evolved. I'm not the Howard Stern from 15, 20 years ago who would have strippers on and would, you know, call, would judge, you know, have Miss Butterface contests and, you know, have mothers and sons who are having sex with each other and all that stuff. Which, by the way, as a Stern, hardcore Stern fan, never particularly interests me. The stripper stuff, I didn't care about the grading the women's asses and boobs and all that. The stuff that I liked about Stern was the inside radio stuff and the drama within the show, which still interests me now, which we're going to do some of this week, by the way, with two idiots we're going to have on later on this week who are going to fight about something stupid. I think I'm going to tape it tomorrow, which I'm half dreading. But anyway, so Stern has now gone, and I guess the narrative is now that he's learned, he's gotten older. And I do understand that when you're 67 or whatever, 65, it's going to be different than when you're 35 or 45. I understand that. But, you know, my biggest issue with Stern is that, not so much that, that's okay. But the idea that he is now, I think he's just, he was either lying 20 years ago or he's lying now. Like, he doesn't find Ellen DeGeneres entertaining. He doesn't find Jennifer Aniston to be funny or Charlize Theron. He had last week, I listened to 5 minutes of it, I wanted to fucking puke. He was just sitting there kissing their asses like, oh. And it was a dreadful interview. The kind of interview, that's the thing. That he was giving the kind of interview that the Stern of 95 would have played and mocked. He's become what he's mocked. And he can avoid that any way he wants. He can act like that's not true, but it is true. He's become what he would once just ruthlessly and hilariously make fun of. He's become a little teddy bear. And, you know, except, and I'll get to for a second, about 3 weeks ago. So Jane Pauley and fucking whoever sit there and kiss his ass and they talk about how he's evolved. And this isn't Stern's fault. This is the media's fault now. And about how he's changed and he had a cancer scare and he appreciates now that he shouldn't be angry and he shouldn't be mean to people. 3 weeks ago, he went on a rant that he's since taken down where he called Wendy Williams the C word repeatedly, called her a rock face, and said she pisses standing up, which to me suggests that she has a penis. About in 2019, calling somebody the C word and saying that they're, you know, have a penis if you're a woman. It's about as angry and hate-filled as you can do. I mean, like, you know, if you're on the radio and you had that rant in any form or fashion, you would be out of your job. But they all ignore that because they like this idea of a softer, cuddlier Howard Stern. And it's just another miss on the media's part, and I find that to be interesting. And Stern is now just a brand. Like, he wants to have people like Carol Burnett on and talk about how much he laughed at, you know, her and Tim Conway, which, you know, 20 years earlier, he was doing bits on how lousy it was. So, you know, that to me is the more interesting thing about Stern is he's just full of shit now. And he likes being soft and being friends with Jimmy Kimmel, and that's okay. He's always craved that. But, you know, he's fucking terrible now. Like, the show is awful. If the show was on the radio in Boston, well, there are some morning shows that would still be better then, obviously. But if it was on the morning, if it was in the mornings, like, if it was a brand new show, people would say, this show sucks. Who is this guy? You know, he's no different now. He's like an older Ryan Seacrest. That's really what he is. And that's okay, but, you know, you can't pretend that you've changed when underneath it all, you're as hateful as ever. But I guess you can when the media ignores it. So anyway, those are the couple of things that interest me. Got some tweets about that podcast Cold that I've been talking up. I know Moroso has been in contact with the creator of that, and he did an unbelievable job, this guy Dave Cawley. I think we're going to have him on next week. Some other guests this week as well. Today we have on Madeline Woods, the class of 2019 at Harvard University. so this we had on the old show I was on, we had this Professor Sullivan, Ronald Sullivan, on when he represented Aaron Hernandez and claimed Hernandez was innocent. Innocent. I think we had him on Patriots Day, like the Monday after he had been acquitted of the second in the second trial, and a couple days before he killed himself, we had Sullivan on. And he was good. We had him on for 20 minutes. He was an excellent guest. And he represents people like that. And somebody he's representing right now is Harvey Weinstein, or was representing Harvey Weinstein. And so the headline over the weekend was that he had been removed from his post as a dean. Not taken away from the law school, but the dean. We'll get into what that is specifically with Madeline in a second. And all over the country, and I fell victim to this as well. And listen, it may be a part of it. Is, you know, hey, this lawyer represents Harvey Weinstein, and a bunch of lefty lunatic Harvard people want to bring him down, and, you know, screw the Sixth Amendment or whatever, and, you know, who cares? And not quite the case. And, you know, Madeline Woods came on. A lot of people, we contacted a lot of people who didn't want to come on and face the music. She did. And I think she does a really good job. She's a smart kid. She goes to Harvard. She just really does a good job outlining why. And she lived at this Winthrop, lived at Winthrop with Sullivan there, represents why, on her end, why they wanted Sullivan out. And the Weinstein thing, according to her, is not a factor at all. When she goes into the things that Sullivan has done, I think it's easier to understand as somebody on the outside why they wouldn't want this guy as the person, basically the proctor, basically the person that they have to go to in these situations. And she lays out situations where people are victims. She's a sexual assault victim herself. Sexual assault victims were essentially laughed out of the room by Sullivan and his wife. Well, you know, if that's the case, then good. I'm glad he's gone. And I wouldn't have known that without having her on having this conversation. As I told her at the end of the interview, we did the interview first and then I taped this. You know, I was looking to bring somebody on to yell about and fight about over this story, but she did a really good job making her case to why Sullivan should have been removed. It's sort of a story that was all over the country over the weekend. And I haven't really heard this side, this case articulated very well. She does a good job of it. Madeline Woods, who joins me right now on Enough About Me. All right, so I went over the stuff with Ronald Sullivan in the open. And as I said, Sullivan had been a guest on my old radio show before when he represented Aaron Hernandez. So now a bunch of students called on him to be removed from his post, and he was. And one of those students joins me right now, Madeline Woods, class of 19. Are you technically a graduate now?
Yeah, well, not yet. Graduation will be in a few weeks.
Okay, what are you going to do after that?
I got a fellowship to Cambridge University.
So you're going to you're just going to continue to be a student for the rest of your life and never do any actual work? That's a good strategy. I would do that. That's smart.
Yeah, I mean, it seems pretty good, all right. I think that's what academia is, actually.
Yes.
But
that's good. You'll be.
We'll see, yeah.
So walk me through this. So the headlines, when I saw them this weekend, and the outrage on the right, of which I sometimes participate in, sort of, it seemed to me that, you know, Sullivan was removed and wiped out of Harvard because he agreed to represent Weinstein. So my understanding, my first thought of the headline was he's, you know, no longer at Harvard at all in any capacity because he was doing what seemed to me to be his obviously perfectly legal right. And the Sixth Amendment is, you know, everybody's entitled. I don't care if you're Harvey Weinstein, who's obviously a creep or somebody who's innocent. You deserve representation, right? So walk me through where the issues are. With a bunch of students at Harvard, I'm looking at these pictures here in the crimson of the people with their mouths covered in the Me Too pictures. Where am I wrong? What am I missing in this whole story?
Yeah, no, of course. I think that's a pretty common misconception. Of course, when you get a headline that has Harvard and Weinstein,
right.
It looks pretty good. But so, yeah, I want to make that clear. Our issue was never with due process. Also, we understand that lawyers are not extensions of their clients. So Ron is not a rapist or someone who has sexual assault. However, he is a faculty dean, and people from the outside tend to not know what that position really means.
All right, he continues to be, he is still at Harvard, he's still employed by Harvard University.
Yes.
But he's no longer... He's no longer a faculty dean, which is what?
Yes. So he's still at the law school.
Mm-hmm.
A faculty dean is a head of the house. So 96% of students stay in the house system. And the house is really a home. It's a close-knit community within the context of the college scene. And they're in charge of programming, events. But also importantly, they handle issues with students, including sexual assault. So, you know, the misconception is that this is about Weinstein. Well, Weinstein initially is what kind of called attention to this. it's actually his comments on, there was another case where an economics professor at Harvard was accused of sexual harassment, the Fryer case. And within that, he's not even a lawyer in that case, but he called the Title IX investigation deeply flawed. And this is a quote, this case, quote, shows what the current Me Too movement, some blood in the water, and good coaching of witnesses can produce. So that was the big issue because, you know, Title IX, for people who aren't familiar, it's a federal civil rights law from 1972, and that basically protects against gender-based discrimination in education and the workplace, which then requires schools, if there is, if a student experiences something like sexual assault, a school is kind of tasked with stopping discrimination, preventing its reoccurrence, and addressing its effects. So, you know, you can imagine when you have a faculty dean who's kind of, this is a strange media reference, but he's kind of like the Dumbledore of the house. When you have someone that you look to as a pastoral kind of pseudo-parental figure, you know, kind of say that the Me Too movement and Title IX investigations are flawed, imagine how a young girl who's been sexually assaulted would feel pretty uncomfortable coming to report her assault to that person whose job is to protect them under Title IX and walk them through Title IX. So really it was the Fryer, you know, Weinstein got the attention and kind of put this under the scrutiny of undergrads, but it was his comments on the Fryer case. And then I'm not sure if you've looked at any other headlines. There's also a very long history of leadership problems and what looks like kind of staff abuse and discrimination as well. So those are the main issues.
So I guess, you know, my question is, you know, was this particular one that he's defending, was it in fact flawed? I mean, I think part of the problem with Me Too is as important as it's been, you know, great to see people stand up and bring down a lot of these creeps, whether it's Weinstein or Spacey or pick whomever, you know, Epstein, whoever, all these people, Matt Lauer, great. But I mean, I do think, you know, don't you have to see where I come to some not reckoning, but maybe a cross in the road is I think there is now this willingness to believe a victim every single time with no investigation. Like right away, it's guilty, guilty, mm-hmm. guilty. There has to be a place, I think, in society where we take a pause, we look at it and say, well, there are two sides to the story. I mean, that seems to me to be a reasonable way to look at it, no?
Oh, yeah, no, I completely agree. I mean, you know, Harvard students were kind of called privileged snowflakes, but I come from a blue-collar working family from rural Colorado. I went to a small school, so I completely understand kind of the concerns of the wider United States looking at how Harvard handles things or even the Me Too movement. And, you know, that is the point of the justice system, right? We have to look at the evidence and look at the process. However, Title IX, you know, the case in Manhattan with Weinstein will go to court, and we support that. He needs a vigorous defense, and if that includes a lawyer who works at Harvard, that's fine. But if that lawyer is also a pastoral figure who has disparaged, you know, a Title IX process by which he is supposed to support by working for the university, then that's an issue. And every Title IX case is different, but it's been in place since 1972, and you know, students really have nowhere else to go. You can say the process is flawed, and I think people are working to make it better all the time. But I mean, that's all you really have. So to disparage that leaves kind of people with, you know, nowhere else to go.
Well, just repeat to me real quick how he disparaged Title IX. I understand he defended them, but what was his particular comments about Title IX?
Yes. He called the investigation deeply flawed, and then the larger context, he said, this investigation, a Title IX investigation, shows what the current Me Too movement, some blood in the water, and good coaching of witnesses can produce.
Well, is there any accuracy to those accusations? I mean, were any witnesses coached? Is it a flawed case? Is it a flawed investigation? I mean, if he's a lawyer questions.
It's still ongoing.
Right. But I mean, so I guess, so Madeline, I guess my point is, though, you know, if you're a lawyer and you're asking so let's just say he lives as a dean in the house where students are. Is that what's going on or no?
Yes. I'm a student in that house.
Okay. So you were in the same place as he was, correct?
Yeah.
Okay. Did you ever feel like you couldn't talk to him about something, or he was somebody who would, let's just say you were sexually assaulted, right? And you went to him. Did you feel that was preventative? Did you feel like you couldn't tell him that? That he's somebody who wouldn't be? Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Really. So I live in the house, and actually, I'll speak to this. It was quoted. So I am a sexual assault survivor.
Okay.
And you know, it's tricky when we went, so we had office hours about this. You know, when they bring us in, and it was very hostile. People were laughed out of the office hours, clapped at
by him.
Point that. By him and his wife. Yeah,
they would. This is a pretty. And I'm sorry that you went through what you went through. This is a pretty serious accusation. So you would go in there, not you, but somebody would go in, who was a victim of potential of sexual assault, and he and his wife would laugh those people out of the room.
Yes, there's a case where for one person that occurred.
Okay.
And in another case, there was an activist who was sued by tutors, who are our versions of RAs. And literally compared to by those tutors to a terrorist, to the bomber. She was directly compared to the 16th Street Baptist Church bomber who killed 4 children in the 60s. So,
I'm confused. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm getting confused. So who the tutors for the school, tutors for students, were compared to bombers by the Sullivans?
No.
I'm confused. I'm sorry.
Tutors are our version of RAs who work within the house.
Yep.
So they're employees of the Sullivans.
Oh, gotcha.
They've been known to support the Sullivans. And over a confrontation that was sparked, you know, over tensions on this case, this woman, an undergraduate, was then compared by the tutors for...
I got you.
To be the 16th Street Baptist.
I got you.
You've come into our house and you've made us, you know, feel unsafe in our house, and then compared her directly to that bomber. And this is a undergraduate woman of color, who's also a refugee.
So why has this been? And maybe you're not the person to answer this. Maybe somebody else is. Why has this message been so? Like, you know, I think I'm sure you've seen on Twitter and on social media. The headline is, like I said, it is. You know, extreme, you know, left-wing Harvard and the Looney Tune communist students, I'm not sure I disagree with any of that, get together and decide to bring down, you know, the first black dean, right, at Harvard, and his wife over the fact that he's representing Harvey Weinstein. You're telling me a different story. What has happened who has screwed up that the message has not been articulated properly?
Well, I think it just makes a good headline. you know, what you just said, that you know, you can get a lot of retweets on that and get a lot of reads. That's not the full story. Of course, you know, Weinstein is what brought the Sullivans under Graetner undergraduate scrutiny. But the reason he was ultimately removed has nothing to do with Weinstein.
Right.
And it really, you know, has to do with tensions within the House in the past few months. And again, I don't know if you've looked up, there's been a long history of staff complaints of leadership. So, for instance, there's another position within the House called the House Administrator. You know, the faculty deans are a figurehead, but the House Administrator does most of the work. In every other house, the average tenure for Harvard Administrator is 10 years. In Winthrop, under the Sullivans, the average has been 10 months.
How long has he been there for?
He's been here 10 years.
As a dean?
As a dean.
Okay, 10 years. And the average one's been 10 months.
The average for House Administrator has been 11 months.
Okay.
And I believe 3 have come forward with emotional abuse claims. So and you can read the article. It's really great. It's called The With Us or Against Us. It's in the Crimson. So those are the issues. I think, you know, if you take a quick glance at it from afar, that is what it looks like. You know, the... what sparked the scrutiny was the Weinstein case, but at the end of the day, that's not that issue. Because also, you know, I think people have thought that they've been demonized here, and, you know, as one of the students who's been pretty active, the Sullivans have done a lot of good work for some people in the House. They are the first African-American deans, which is an amazing thing, and we shouldn't forget that. However, over the past decade, culminating in these last few very tense months, they've also made a lot of mistakes. And like any job, you have to be accountable to your mistakes. And I think they've been held accountable by the college.
What was your did you have any specific, you know, tough moments with either Sullivan or his wife? I mean, were there any moments where they specifically said things to you? You said, you know, this is inappropriate, that you wanted to go forward and talk about?
Not directly.
What's the worst? Go ahead. No, I'm good.
Yeah. So there were some emails sent out from them discussing the case. And in those emails, you know, it was the usual, you know, the straw man was set up that this was about due process. Again, I want to make it very clear that no one is against due process. That's like a very simple thing, and we're very supportive of that. However, just the idea that we wanted to have a conversation about this and how it would affect students, we were immediately portrayed as, I mean, there's quotes, you know, the mob. There was kind of the insinuation that you're the enemy of discussion and other points of view, which I think is just wrong and really kind of led to this tense situation in which an undergraduate was threatened to be sued. Those same tutors are actually suing another faculty dean from a different house for defamation. So it's just gotten so messy. And again, I don't think it had to be this way. You know, the questions were asked initially, and, you know, this kind of lifted the veil on other leadership problems in the house that had been going on for years. But, you know, if they'd let people know that they were taking this case early on, no one knew in the administration. I think this could have been, and even if they'd handled it differently, just to kind of listen to students and their concerns as opposed to immediately shutting down and immediately kind of using due process as a shield, I think this could have been really avoided. But this is where we're at now, and the college has made a decision, and a lot of people feel, quite frankly, relieved, myself included.
So he's Fryer. Is he one of Fryer's lawyers as well?
So that's tricky. In the account where these quotes come from, he was referenced as a lawyer.
The story I read was the real.
It's come out that he's not a lawyer.
Okay, I read the Real Clear Investigations story that said he was his lawyer. So he's not. And then he said
he's not a lawyer. Yeah, for the Fryer.
Well, he's not Fryer's lawyer.
Kind of makes it more damning because he had no reason to make those. You know, you could kind of say, oh, I made those comments to support my client. That's not actually how I feel. But in this case, he wasn't the lawyer, so that you kind of have to assume that is just genuinely how he feels.
Is there any proof at all? I mean, he basically accused the students involved in the Fryer investigation of being coached. Is there any proof that that happened?
No.
No proof?
Not that I'm aware of.
And you find that, I would imagine, I'm speaking for you, and I think you've articulated that, you find that to be far more disturbing, that accusation, than the fact that he's representing Weinstein, I would guess, right?
Yeah, of course. That's, you know, having that thrown at you when women for years, myself included, you know, this didn't happen to me when I was in college, but, you know, the accusation that, oh, you're making this up, or, oh, it's not true, or, oh, I'm not sure it happened the way you said it did, that's a long narrative that's been very harmful. So, yeah, that is the main issue we had. And again, as a student, if a student was sexually assaulted while here, to come to a person who, you know, kind of questions the validity of sexual assault claims, you know, you already feel like you're losing.
I think it's more right. And I'm glad you're telling me this, because I find that to be much more. So you've been a victim of it.
Yeah.
And it's a terrible thing. But let's say it happened to you 6 months ago, and you knew this was going on, the stuff with Fryer was going on. That I can understand at that point, where you would say, geez, why would I tell this person that? I mean, he's not,
yeah,
you know,
that would be a huge issue, because there's been a history at Harvard, especially, of issues of sexual assault. I mean, the hunting ground, I think that's why the college has kind of come down. And, you know, the college is so funny. They've made wild mistakes, you know, where they sanction single-sex organizations to help sexual assault, but then, you know, they won't beef up their Title IX, and you can't get a rape kit at their health services. So yeah, there's a lot of issues with Harvard, don't worry, sexual assault, but I think this is just, you know, kind of part of that. So I'm happy they're finally taking action on something that seems real.
I sometimes wonder if it's so, you know, I'm a 44-year-old white guy, right? When Me Too broke out, I was on the radio a couple of years ago, and I have to admit, I was gobsmacked, not the idea that these guys were creeps or perverts, like we had heard about some of these people like Spacey for years, even Matt Lauer a little bit, but the amount of people, and we would take call after call from women in workplaces who were like, I don't know why you guys are acting like this is a big surprise. Me, all my friends, this has happened to everyone. And I have to admit, like, and I guess shame on me to some extent, I was totally blindsided by the volume of which it has happened. I wonder if the people in Harvard who are still in power, I guess, are probably still mostly older white guys, like everywhere else, and their head is probably buried in the sand over this stuff. And when shit happens where they don't know how to handle it, stuff like this is what happens.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, it's hard to explain something to people when it hasn't directly happened to them. So I think that is the bonus of the Me Too movement. Of course, like you said at the beginning, with anything that comes to justice, we have to look at the evidence. So we always kind of have to take a moment to see if something's credible. But the fact that there's such volume is not that this is new or that witnesses are being coached. It's just that this has been happening all along and people haven't felt able to speak to it, which I think that's why the Me Too movement is so important, because people now feel like they'll be believed or at the very least listened to.
Well, I think the other irony is, I just had this him on maybe 3 weeks ago, is if I said to you, who's the most famous professor at Harvard University, who'd you say?
Oh, gosh.
Oh, I mean,
Steven Pinker, maybe
Alan Dershowitz, I would say.
Oh God! Yeah.
Right. So as this goes on, right, and you guys do your thing with Ms. Sullivan, Dershowitz, who is probably the most famous lawyer, maybe in the second half of the 20th century. Like I said, I had him on the podcast a few weeks ago. He came on and defended himself strongly about the accusations. He represented somebody who was every bit as much in Weinstein's class as Jeffrey Epstein, right, and was by the way himself, Dershowitz, accused of rape by several women. So I wonder, you know, as Sullivan gets taken away from this post, I wonder what's going to go on with him. What is the movement, if any, toward Dershowitz from the student body? Is there any?
I don't think so. I mean, obviously people view him with a bit of hesitation because of those accusations, but I think this really drives home clear that the issue is not about Weinstein, it's not about due process, because we're not coming after him. When you're in an academic position, a solely academic position, and you're not in charge of handling Title IX, then, of course, you're a defense lawyer. What you're supposed to do is defend probably not great people. If everyone were wonderful, we wouldn't need defense lawyers. So I really don't see, unless something comes of, you know, accusations against him as an individual, maybe.
Well, there have been. I mean, there have been against Dershowitz.
Yes, of course. Right. If something, you know, if something more comes of that, then potentially, because you don't want rapists, you know, on your payroll or as a professor, but just him as a lawyer defending, you know, people that the rest of America or the rest of humanity doesn't view as a great person, that's not the issue. Because again, everyone, no matter how deplorable, has the right to a vigorous defense.
That being said, that being
fully support that. The only issue is when that comes in conflict with the lives of students, and you know, when it presents a conflict of interest. That's the only issue there.
That being said, so let's say Sullivan was, you know, the greatest guy in the world to you guys. There's none of the other stories at all. None of the other stuff had happened. You all loved him.
Yeah.
And he's a lawyer, and one day he decides to represent Weinstein. Do you feel like it was his duty, like I said, even if he was the greatest guy in the world, to let the women know, the females in the building know, hey, I'm going to do this, and here's why I'm doing it?
Yeah, I do. Because, you know, there's issues where the trauma kind of follows you around, and there's a lot of resources on campus where if he'd alerted them, I think they could have been there immediately. It would have showed that he, you know, he values his job as a defense lawyer, but he also values his job as someone in charge of students. That is our only issue here. This decision and the lack of warning and then the lack of care afterwards showed us that he values his position as a lawyer much more than he values his decision, his position as a faculty dean. And that was one of the main issues. So yeah, if nothing else had happened and he had been the best faculty dean and he had warned people, I again don't think there would have been as much issue. Some people might have been uncomfortable, of course. I can't speak for everyone. It will be hard, admittedly, to see someone you look up to questioning, grilling witnesses on a stand who, you know, as someone who's survived sexual assault, kind of reminds you of yourself. That will be rough. It wasn't just the decision, but the case. And now he's stepped away, of course, so we don't have to deal with that.
But there has to be a place in society, you agree, for a lawyer to do his natural job of just questioning things. I mean, there has to be, that has to exist.
Absolutely. That is a cornerstone of why this country is great, and of law, of justice. And absolutely no one in this movement has ever questioned the right to due process. The only issue has been his other comments, leadership issues in the House.
Well, I would say the laughing the accusers out of a room would be a concern for me.
Yeah.
You know, that's sort of my biggest token. I didn't know that. Do you consider yourself a feminist?
I consider myself a feminist in the way that it's defined that just for equality, yes.
What that means, equality, is that what you said?
Yeah.
Does the Me Too movement, is there anything about it that gives you pause? I mean, like I said, there's a lot of good things about it, but is there anything about it that concerns you, or put it this way, in having been the victim yourself, do you believe the victim, the accuser, right away? Like, are you blinded by what you have gone through, and that is sort of bias you to the point that you're going to believe them no matter what?
No, you can't.
No? Well, I don't know. It'd be perfectly natural given what you've been through. I just don't, I'm curious about the thought process.
That's a completely fair question. Of course, I tend to view them with empathy, and I try to hear them out, because I understand that until the past few years in this movement, that wouldn't have been possible. But of course, you always have to, there's a reason there's a trial, right? And it is to question them and to push for evidence. And that has to exist. Should we listen to them and not immediately demonize them, no matter how beloved the person they're accusing is? Yes, they should be treated with respect, despite who they're accusing. But of course, you also have to view it through the mind of justice. You can't just immediately believe someone.
Were you a assault victim in high school?
Younger.
Oh, geez. Well, that's awful.
Yeah.
So, Jesus. I don't know how specific you want to get into it. I mean, was it a family member?
Extended.
Yeah. Extended family member. Okay. Do you feel like, you were so young, I guess the question. So if it had happened while you were in high school, do you feel more emboldened now, say even 3 or 4 years later, that you might be more likely to come forward because of the Me Too movement than even say when you were a freshman versus now?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the great things from it, right? I mean, at least people will, they won't sit there and, I just hate, you know, and the other thing is, and I get on this high horse all the time because I battle it, is so much of it is, you know, and whoever did this to you, so many of these people are so mentally ill, and they're just so ignored for years, and they're not treated, and they're sort of, you know, it's easier just not to deal with them, and then they do these horrible things, and it's just, you know, it's just this endless cycle that I fear sometimes, even with the Me Too movement, is not going to slow down until the mental health stigma is somehow acknowledged and taken care of.
I completely agree with that. And I think that's why we need to, you know, start when people are young. That's why education on seeing the signs of someone who might do this and kind of nipping it in the bud is important. And then just, supporting one another. I think there's a lot of people who are hurting, or people who come to power and kind of feel like they can control other people in this way. I think that's what we see in the Weinstein case and others. I think the Me Too movement is past preventative, and I think it's important, but if we can start exactly looking at mental health and looking at the signs, that's really where we want to move to, because we don't want to move to justice for survivors or victims. If we can get to the point where there are fewer survivors in the first place, then I think that's the end goal.
So what is you go to Cambridge, then what are you going to do with your life? What's your future here?
I'm thinking medical research, so okay. I work with medicinal plants. Either medical research or writing, academia, but yeah, something to help people out would be great.
Well, good, good. That's great.
I'm still an idealist. I'm still in college.
Yes, that will end.
So
that
don't
will,
ruin it for me.
Believe me, that will end. That will end swiftly and ugly, but you'll be fine. I could tell, even for a Harvard commie socialist, you know, hippie, you're okay. I'm a fan, Madeline, and I appreciate you. It takes a lot of guts, first of all, to go through what you've gone through and still talk about it. And I do appreciate. So, you know, I saw the headline and I texted my producer and I was like, let's bring one of these lefty loons on and just you know, destroy them over this stupid thing. But then I started reading about it and said, okay, there's more. I thought it was quite simply they objected to a guy who was defending somebody in court, which drove me crazy. I mean, which, you know,
yeah,
is natural.
I completely agree.
And I appreciate you coming on and articulating your side. And good luck with everything going forward. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much. And thank you for inviting me on again. Just like you said, a lot of the headlines are pretty sensationalist. So thank you for kind of doing the good journalistic.
That's always me. Look me up. You'll find it. And good luck with your future with plants and academia. It sounds exciting.
Thank you.
All right, Madeline. Thanks so much.
All right. Thank you. Bye.
All right, if you haven't already, I don't know why you haven't, but if you have not, remember to subscribe to this podcast, Enough About Me, on the radio.com app, iTunes, Google Play, or Stitcher. iTunes ratings and reviews help me and the podcast, so take a minute and leave one, please. It actually helps. I know it's a pain in the ass. It's a waste of time. That's what you're thinking, but it actually isn't. It actually helps me, keeps me going, so I can do this podcast, okay, so I can live. You're going to help me stay alive if you subscribe, so do it, all right? Dummies, get to work.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of four lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.